From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, Lin-Manuel Miranda talks about his phenomenally successful Broadway show Hamilton and about the statement he co-wrote addressed to Mike Pence when Pence attended a performance of Hamilton in December. And we'll hear some of the first rhymes Miranda wrote in ninth grade.
Notice my voice went up about two octaves. It's because at that time I was listening to nothing but The Far Side. And my favorite rapper in The Far Side had that. Well, there she goes again, the dopest Ethiopian.
Also, Damien Chazelle, the writer and director of the new musical La La Land, talks about making the film and why he loves musicals.
Movies have kind of been engineered over the century to somewhat reflect reality. And musicals just break that, and they break it in the name of emotion. And that was a really beautiful idea to me, that if you feel enough, you break in a song.
That's on Fresh Air Weekend. First News. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lin-Manuel Miranda, has left his title role in Hamilton, his hip-hop musical about the Founding Fathers. But this Broadway sensation keeps growing. A production of the show is running in Chicago. Another production will be opening in London. The Hamilton mixtape was recently released, featuring covers of songs from the show by artists like Usher, Alicia Keys, and The Roots. The Broadway production won 11 Tonys, and Hamilton won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama. Miranda's first Broadway show, In the Heights, was a musical set in a Latino neighborhood in New York, similar to the one he grew up in. In 2008, it won the Tony for Best Musical. Miranda is nominated for a Golden Globe for one of the songs he wrote for the new Disney animated film Moana. Let's start with that song. The story is about the daughter of the chief on a Polynesian island. She yearns to leave the island, have an adventure, and find her true calling. This is the anthem Moana sings before setting out on her own. It's called How Far I'll Go. It's sung by Auli'i Cravalho.
See the line where the sky meets the sea. It calls me, and no one knows how far it goes. If the wind is my sail on the sea, stays behind. No telling how far I'll go. I know everybody on this island seems so happy on this island. Everything is by design. I know everybody on this island has a role on this island, so maybe I can roll with mine. I can lead with pride. I can make a strong.
Lin-Manuel Miranda, welcome to Fresh Air. So what did you do to get into the mindset of an adolescent girl yearning to leave her safe little island paradise and have an adventure and find her calling?
I just remembered when I was an adolescent girl longing to leave my island and find my calling. Just went right back there.
Absolutely.
That's not a glib answer. I think the fun of writing that song was finding the specificity in the story you're telling. This is not someone who hates where they live and wants to go somewhere else. This is someone who loves where they live, and yet there's still this voice saying they should go somewhere else. And so that's messier, you know, that's more complicated. And to that end, I actually went to my parents' house, holed up at my childhood piano, and wrote in my old bedroom, because I figured, let me get to that feeling of sort of, there's an impossible distance between me and what I want when you're in your childhood bedroom.
So what was the thing you wanted that there was an impossible distance from when you were an adolescent?
A life in this business, mm-hmm. You know, a life making stuff. I have two wonderful, supportive, and very practical parents who were like, you're really talented and really creative. You should be a lawyer, because there's a safe path there. And I knew I was never going to be a lawyer. And I knew that I wanted to make movies, and I wanted to write shows. And the distance between 200th Street and that just felt very wide. So I kind of got back to that place.
Did you go to a lot of Disney animated films when you were growing up? And did the music of those mean anything to you?
Yeah, I had the great joy of being 9 years old when The Little Mermaid came out. And I went and saw that 3 times in the theater. Then I dragged my parents back and my family back to see it a couple more times. I don't know why it changed my life as much as it did. I think Sebastian the Crab had a big amount to do with it. The fact that this Calypso number happens under the water just knocked my socks off when I was a kid.
Okay, so I want to talk to you about Hamilton. and so let's start with my shot. And
sure.
So this is...
Which is the, you know, an adolescent who wants to go out and change the world. I mean, it's a Disney princess song.
Okay, that's interesting. This is Alexander Hamilton making his big statement about how, you know, he's come to America, he's going to make it, and he's not giving away his shot, you know, and
yeah.
First it's going to be in the Revolutionary War and then in the new American government. So let's hear some of it, and then we'll talk. So this is Lin-Manuel Miranda from the cast recording of Hamilton.
I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. I'ma get a scholarship to King's College. I probably shouldn't brag, but dag, I'm amazed and astonished. The problem is I got a lot of brains, but no polish. I gotta holler just to be heard with every word. I drop knowledge. I'm a diamond in the rough. A shiny piece of coal, trying to reach my goal. My power of speech, unimpeachable. Only 19, but my mind is older. These New York City streets get colder. I shoulder every burden, every disadvantage I've learned to manage. I don't have a gun to brandish. I walk these streets famished. The plan is to fan this spark into a flame. But damn, it's getting dark, so let me spell out the name. I am the A-L-E-X-A-N-D-E-R. We are meant to be a colony that runs into...
That's Lin-Manuel Miranda from his cast recording of Hamilton. So you are so incredible at these like intricate rhymes that you do in this show. How do you assemble all these intricately placed rhymes?
For me, the fun of writing my shot was it's Hamilton's declaration of purpose, and I wanted to demonstrate his intellect and his ambition, not just in what he was saying, but in the way he was saying it. So prior to his arrival and singing my shot, the other guys in that bar, right, Lawrence, Mulligan, and Lafayette, are rhyming at the end of the line. It's, I'm John Lawrence in the place to be, 2 pints of San Adams, but I'm working on 3. We rhyme at the end of the line. And then here comes Hamilton, and suddenly you're getting a lot of internal assonance and a lot of internal rhyming. And not content to just rhyme at the end of the line, but, you know, have these big pun-esque lyrics, you know, I know the action in the street is exciting, but Jesus, between all the bleeding and fighting, I've been reading and writing. So it's, they're intricately tied together. And if you consider that Hamilton is delivering this in real time, suddenly you're like, whoa, this is the greatest freestyler who ever lived. And so that was the fun in constructing that. And it was many days and months of work to sort of make his lyrics just that much more intricate than everybody else's.
Because he was so smart and so verbal.
Yes.
Yeah. So Hamilton has such an interesting connection to the White House for 2 reasons. The show basically originates at the White House. You started off thinking of Hamilton as a concept album about Alexander Hamilton. And the first time you performed one of the songs, the opening song from the show, it was at the White House. What was it, like an evening of American music or something that Michelle Obama
presented? Yeah, it was
an
evening of poetry and spoken word, yeah. And it was in about May of 2009, you know, fresh new administration, and thrilled to be asked. And I had written the verses for what became the opening number of Hamilton and then sort of adapted it to that room.
Okay, let's hear a little bit of that performance at the White House from 2009. Here's Lin-Manuel Miranda.
I'm thrilled the White House called me tonight because I'm actually working on a hip-hop album. It's a concept album about the life of someone I think embodies hip-hop, Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton. You laugh, But it's true. He was born a penniless orphan in St. Croix of illegitimate birth, became George Washington's right-hand man, became Treasury Secretary, caught beef with every other founding father, and all on the strength of his writing. I think he embodies the word's ability to make a difference. So I'm going to be doing the first song from that tonight. I'm accompanied by Tony and Grammy-winning music director Alex Lacamoire. Anything you need to know, I'll be playing Vice President Aaron Burr, and snap along if you like. How does a bastard orphan son of a whore and a Scotsman dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by Providence, impoverished and squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar? The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter. By 14, they had placed him in charge of a trade and charter. And every day while slaves were being slaughtered or carted away across the waves, our Hamilton kept his guard up inside. He was longing for something to be a part of the brother.
That's Lin-Manuel Miranda performing the opening number from Hamilton at the White House with Michelle and Barack Obama in the audience. So let's skip ahead to just a few weeks ago when Vice President-elect Mike Pence attended Hamilton, and he was cheered, he was booed when he was there. And then when the show was over, Brandon Victor Dixon, who now plays Aaron Burr, came out and read like a little speech directed to Mike Pence. And I'll read some of it for our listeners who might not have heard this yet. This is what he said. Mm-hmm. Vice President-elect Pence, we welcome you, and we truly thank you for joining us here at Hamilton in American Musical. We really do. We, sir, are the diverse America who are alarmed and anxious that your new administration will not protect us, our planet, our children, our parents, or defend us and uphold our inalienable rights, sir. But we truly hope this show has inspired you to uphold our American values and to work on behalf of all of us, all of us. Thank you truly for seeing this show, this wonderful American story, told by a diverse group of men, women of different colors, creeds, and orientations. So you co-wrote this. That's my understanding. You co-wrote it with the director and the producer. Do I have that right?
Yes, with Tommy and Jeffrey. We got the heads up that he was coming that afternoon and sort of put that together before his arrival.
Okay, so what was the conversation like between you and whoever else was involved about whether you should say something or not?
Well, the conversation was, this has been an incredibly divisive election with a lot of hurt feelings and disappointment and anger on both sides. And the overwhelming sort of statement within that statement is, we truly hope you lead all of us. We're a play that tells the story of our founders with a very diverse company that we feel, reflects what our country looks like now. And so it was really intended as an olive branch, please lead all of us. And what I was really grateful for was that Sunday, Mike Pence really was grateful for that, and I think got it in the sentiment in which it was intended. He said, I wasn't offended. I assure you that we are trying to lead all of you. And so I was grateful for his statements and for him stopping to listen. He didn't have to do that, but he did. And I thought it felt like a civil dialogue between us.
So you said Vice President-elect Mike Pence took this speech very well. President-elect Trump did not. He tweeted, the theater must always be a safe and special place. The cast of Hamilton was very rude last night to a very good man, Mike Pence. Apologize! ! And he tweeted, our wonderful future Vice President Mike Pence was harassed last night at the theater by the cast of Hamilton, cameras blazing. This should not happen! ! What was your reaction to the tweets?
Well, here's where I agree with the president-elect. The theater should always be a safe space. It's, in fact, I think one of the reasons Hamilton's been embraced by people of every stripe on the political spectrum is that theater is one of the rarest places where we still come together. You know, you may take a totally different conclusion from Hamilton than I do based on your ideology and your politics and your life experience, but we all sat in a room together and we watched the same thing. And that doesn't happen anymore. As you can see from this election, we have our own sets of facts based on who we listen to, which news organization gets our business determines the facts that get in our head. So, you know, I think one of the things that makes theater special is, first of all, it's one of the last places you put your phone away. And second of all, it's one of the last places where we all have a common experience together. So, you know, to that end, I agree with him. I don't agree with his characterization of what we did. I think anyone who sees that video sees Brandon silencing the boos that were not coming from anyone involved in our company, but from the audience itself, who were 9 days after the election are still working through that thing. I can't speak to that. But I know that Brandon quieted the boos and made a plea to lead all of us. And I don't believe there's anything remotely resembling harassment in what we've done.
My guest is Lin-Manuel Miranda, the creator and original star of the Broadway hip-hop musical Hamilton. We'll talk more after a short break, and we'll hear from Damien Chazelle, the writer and director of the new movie musical La La Land. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles, at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And from Stitch Fix, a personal styling service for women and men that has users fill out a style quiz with their taste, budget, and style preferences. The stylists learn what customers like before sending hand-picked clothes. Learn more at stitchfix.com.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with Lin-Manuel Miranda, the creator of Hamilton, the Broadway hip-hop phenomenon about the Founding Fathers, which won 11 Tonys and the Pulitzer Prize for Drama. So Hamilton is in part a story about an immigrant and about immigrants, and which of course relates to your family background. Your father came to New York from Puerto Rico for college. And your mother...
Technically making him not an immigrant because Puerto Rico is a commonwealth, but the experience of Spanish to English and displacement is very similar.
Exactly. And your mother, I think, moved as an infant to the U.S. from Puerto Rico.
Correct.
And you grew up in a predominantly Latino neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You went to, like, the Hunter College Elementary and High School. Do I have that right?
That's right.
Yeah. So you've spoken in the past about this divide between who you were at home and in your Latino neighborhood and who you were at school with friends. What was the difference between those two yous?
Oh, man, I feel like we've just stepped into code switch because that's that's what I was doing. I think that's sort of the interesting thing. I mean, I think if you want to make a recipe for making a writer, have them feel a little out of place everywhere. Have them be an observer kind of all the time. And that's a great way to make a writer. I won the lotto when I got into Hunter. To get a great free public school education sort of saved my family, and I was aware of it. I was aware of that I was at a school with kids who were really smart. And I also had friends in the neighborhood who went to the local school. And I remember feeling that drift happen. You know, when you spend your entire day with someone, your closer friends become the ones you go to school with. And yet I'd still have sleepovers with the friends from the neighborhood, make movies with my friends from the neighborhood. And the corner of that I lived in was like this little Latin American country. It's one in which the nanny who lived with us and raised us, who also raised my father in Puerto Rico, never needed to learn English. All of the business owners in and around our block all spoke Spanish. And yet I'd go to school and I'd be at my friends' houses on the Upper East Side and Upper West Side, and I'd be the one translating to the nanny who spoke Spanish. So it's interesting to become a Latino cultural ambassador when you're seven. You know what I mean? So I had that experience as well. So, you know, we change depending on the room we're in. I'm talking quieter because I'm talking to Terry Gross.
So you obviously, you know, love rap and hip hop. What were the first recordings that made a big impression? The first rap recordings that made a big impression on you?
I have several. I remember my sister bringing home the Fat Boys when I was really little, and also taking me to the first hip hop movies. I remember going to see Beat Street and mm-hmm. going to see Breakin' as a really little kid, being sort of dragged along by my older sister. My sister is as responsible for anyone for giving me good taste in music. I remember stealing her copy of Black Sheep's A Wolf in Sheep's Clothing and learning engine number 9 on the New York Transit Line. I think that's probably the first rap song I really worked hard to memorize in sixth grade. But then also, Naughty by Nature and Queen Latifah. The music you love when you're a teenager is always going to be the most important to you. And I find that it's all over the score of Hamilton. The quotes are Biggie quotes. They're a big pun. I mean, these are all New York East Coast 90s rappers. And that's when I was a teenager.
So I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you to do one of the first rhymes that you remember writing, that you still remember today.
Well, hello, my name is Lynn, but if you're dyslexic, call me Nil. My rhymes are gonna kill, so I suggest you write your will and leave your to me. I am the epitome. Your coolness can't be writ to me because I will be hitting the mic tonight. Notice my voice went up about two octaves. It's because at that time I was listening to nothing but The Far Side, and my favorite rapper in The Far Side had that. Well, there she goes again, the dopest Ethiopian, and now the world around me. It was that cadence, and I think my rapper voice is still influenced by Far Side. But those lines were a rhyme I wrote in ninth grade that I showed to friends, and they were like, all right, stick to your day job.
Oh, come on, that was pretty good. That was funny.
Yeah.
So, okay, and I'm going to put you on the spot one more time. Your father has or had a political consulting company. He worked with New York mm-hmm. City Mayor Ed Koch. He still has it, and advising him on Latino affairs. And you apparently wrote jingles when you were younger for this political consulting company that your father owns. Mm-hmm. So how old were you when you started writing them? And please sing one for us.
Well, jingles is misleading because it sounds like, how I wait to wake up in the morning. It's not, they're not like I Like Ike. It's background music for commercials. So there's nothing catchy I can sing you. But yeah, I started writing those really out of college. I was paying the rent like every other struggling writer. And I was teaching part-time seventh grade English at my old school at Hunter. And then after a year of teaching regularly, I went into just subbing, being a professional sub to have more time to write. And then my dad would, I was basically cheap labor for my dad. He would say, I need 30 seconds of some jazz for a Sharpton spot that's going to be on WBLS. Or I need some bright salsa for a Fernando Ferrer campaign commercial. You know, I wrote music for Elliot Spitzer before we knew what we knew when he was running for governor. I wrote for Carl McCall. And whatever Democrat was running or my dad was working with, I was writing the campaign music. I liked writing the negative ads more than because it's more minor chords. You just kind of hit the synthesizer. Politician X voted against. Da, 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 and then it ends with bright salsa. Dun, 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 dun. Vote. Politician Y.
Oh, that's great. So, you know how you were talking about the compartmentalized you were when you were at home and in your Latino neighborhood, and the you were at school when your friends mm-hmm. were white and not Latino, and then you learned finally to bring all those parts together. Was the same kind of compartmentalization happening for you musically? You loved Broadway shows, and you loved hip-hop, and it's maybe hard to find people who, when they're teens, love both.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And honestly, what a fantastic question, because theater is really the thing that began to break that divide for me. My senior year in high school, I was the director of the school musical, and I picked West Side Story, painfully aware that there were not enough Latino kids to play all the sharks in West Side Story at Hunter, or at least audition. And so what that became for me was actually this kind of weird way of bringing my culture to school. I remember being knocked out when I first saw the movie in sixth grade that there's actually a musical number in the canon about whether you should stay in Puerto Rico and live in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's amazing when you're 12 and you grow up in New York and your family's all from this other island, to have that conversation happening in front of you in an iconic musical. I had my white and Asian sharks, and I brought my dad in, and he did dialect coaching. You know, while they're singing America, I want the things they're yelling while they're cheering each other on to be accurate. I want the accents to be accurate. So it actually became a way to bring home to school, directing that production. Also, you know, I think I started writing musicals because I saw Rent on my 17th birthday, and I can't overstate how much that gave me permission to write musicals. You know, I loved musicals. I loved being in the school play, but they always took place in some other time and place. You know, it's Phantom is in Paris, and Les Mis is in, you know, they're all, a lot of them in France, a lot of the ones I grew up with in the 80s. But they always took place in some mythical time, some mythical place. And here is this musical, and it's about artists living in the village right now. And I think I started writing because no one had ever told me you can write about the things you know in a musical. They don't have to come from some far off place.
Well, Lin-Manuel Miranda, it's just been wonderful to talk with you. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you so very much.
Likewise. The joy is mine.
Lin-Manuel Miranda created the musical Hamilton and originated the title role. Our next guest, Damien Chazelle, wrote and directed the new movie musical La La Land, which is firmly set in the present but pays loving tribute to movie musicals of the past. The New York Film Critics Circle named it the best picture of 2016, and so did our film critic David Edelstein. Chazelle also wrote and directed the 2014 film Whiplash, about a jazz student and his sadistically demanding teacher. La La Land stars Emma Stone as an aspiring actress who keeps going to auditions and getting rejected. Ryan Gosling plays a jazz pianist who wants to open his own club in order to do his part to keep jazz alive, but he's usually stuck playing awful gigs at restaurants and parties. They have two brief, unfortunate encounters with each other and then meet again at a party in which he's playing synthesizer in a cover band. They leave at the same time, she can't find her car, and he helps her look for it. They obviously like each other, but neither is willing to admit it, which leads them to sing, "What a Waste of a Lovely Night."
The sun is nearly gone, the lights are turning on, a silver shine that stretches to the sea. We stumble on a view that's tailor-made for two. What a shame, those two are you and me. Some other girl and guy would love this swirling sky, but there's only you and I, and we've got no shot. This could never be, you're not the type for me, and there's not a spark inside. What a waste of a lovely night.
You say there's nothing here, well then
something clear. I think I'll be the one to make that call.
It's your call.
And though you look so cute in your polyester suit,
it's wool.
You're right, I'd never fall for you at all. Or it could be less than nothing.
Good to know, so you agree.
That's right.
What a waste of a lovely night.
Well, you know, after hearing that song, those two are going to get together. Damien Chazelle, welcome to Fresh Air. I love the film. I'm so glad you made it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, I know you love musicals. So do I. A lot of people think of musicals as out of date and that there's something inherently false about breaking into song in the middle of a movie. So what do you love about musicals and why did you want to make one?
You know, I think that in a way the sort of defiance of reality that breaking into a song in the middle of a movie represents, I think was what really initially keyed me in. I wasn't necessarily a giant fan of musicals as a kid. I was a giant fan of movies. There were certain musicals that really spoke to me, Wizard of Oz and West Side Story and a few others. But it wasn't until I actually started making kind of experimental films and ironically documentaries in college that I think my eyes got kind of reawakened or awakened to especially old classic Hollywood musicals. And there was something about them that felt like, oh my God, okay, here is an experimental movie in mainstream packaging. There's something so kind of brash and defiant and almost avant-garde about the idea of just breaking the normal rules of, you know, normal reality. Movies have kind of been engineered over the century to somewhat reflect reality, usually, even if it's a fantasy or something. There's some kind of an assumption that things are going to follow a certain order. And musicals just break that, and they break it in the name of emotion. And that, I think, was a really powerful, beautiful idea to me, that if you feel enough, you break into song.
And I think in La La Land, there's the sense that the songs are the heightened emotion that people are feeling. It literally breaks from reality. The colors become more vivid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things just kind of change, and then they go back to normal after the song ends. And it's as if you're saying, this is what they're thinking. This is the heightened reality that they're imagining or wishing for.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Yeah, I mean, movies are kind of limited by what you see in front of the camera, which means that you know, it's a sort of physical medium. You can't really reflect interiority the way a novel can. And that's always the gripe about movies, that you can't get as deep into characters' feelings as you can in literature. And I think musicals find this wonderful way around that, because the songs are, I think in a good musical, are an expression of inner feelings that can't be articulated any other way.
My guest is Damien Chazelle, the writer and director of the new movie musical La La Land. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Rhodes Scholar, a nonprofit organization providing educational travel adventures, including experiences for families, grandparents, and grandchildren. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org. And from Home Instead Senior Care, offering customized in-home senior care services from bathing and medication reminders to Alzheimer's care. More at homeinstead.com/NPR.
Thank you. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with Damien Chazelle, the writer and director of the new movie musical La La Land, which is nominated for 7 Golden Globes and was voted Best Picture of the Year by the New York Film Critics Circle. Chazelle also wrote and directed the 2014 film Whiplash, about a student jazz drummer and his overly demanding teacher. La La Land stars Emma Stone as an aspiring actress who keeps getting rejected at auditions, Ryan Gosling as a jazz pianist who wants to open his own club and keep jazz alive, but often has to take gigs playing music he doesn't like. The opening of the film is really amazing. It's a bumper-to-bumper traffic jam in L.A. on the freeway. I'm not familiar with the freeway, so I don't know exactly where it is.
It's the 105 and the 110. So when you're sightseeing in L.A. next time, you can...
Yes, I can hope to be trapped on the
freeway.
You
can hope to be trapped on that one.
I'll look forward to that. So everybody's bumper to bumper, and you have this like slow pan where we're hearing what each car radio or, you know, is playing or whatever device they're listening to is playing. Then slowly people start getting out of their cars and singing and dancing. And the choreography is amazing. I'm going to ask you to describe what's going on.
Well, we're on this kind of elevated freeway ramp that's in utter gridlock. And as you say, yeah, one by one, characters start to kind of join in this collective number. And the idea was to sort of go from individual car radio, and all of these individual sounds building and sort of layering into this one kind of collective song. That eventually explodes into just full-out, joyful, unison singing and dancing before all the drivers return to their, return to their cars. But the idea was to sort of introduce the world and, I think, even more importantly, begin the musical with as musical-esque a scene as we could possibly imagine. Like, really try to announce our intentions right off the bat with a bang.
And announce that these scenes are not necessarily real, the musical scenes. Mm-hmm. They're breaking from reality. They're a wishful reality because everybody is not really going to get out of the car and sing and dance.
alas.
Yes. But the choreography is amazing. Like, people are, like, dancing on and jumping onto the roofs of cars. And there's skateboard skates over the cars and a bicyclist. And it's just, it's like, choreographed beautiful mayhem. And I was thinking how hard it must have been to shoot that and to choreograph everything so everybody's in the right part of the frame at the right moment. How did you manage to do it? Like, what were some of the like logistical hurdles you had in shooting that scene?
Well, one thing that I think that, has kind of been lost a little bit is the idea of choreographing dance for the camera. That, to me, was the beautiful thing about old Hollywood musicals, from Fred and Ginger through the Gene Kelly, Stanley Donen pictures to something like Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, which was, there's a wonderful barn dance set piece in the middle of that movie, which was a kind of big reference for this, with a lot of the same sort of athletic kind of dancing. But it's all about how the dance looks in relation to a single camera, not let's do the dance like a live event and just film it with 15 cameras and then we'll find it in the editing room. So that sort of long take aesthetic was there right from the beginning. And my choreographer, Mandy Moore, had to choreograph with that in mind. And the DP, Lena Sandgren, had to, had to kind of be involved in that choreography. So it was really the three of us and this troupe of dancers that Mandy kind of, Mandy and I sort of brought together, rehearsing for months, and often very theoretically, because the other problem with shooting on a freeway ramp is that you can't really rehearse on site very easily. And so we were able to, find this elevated ramp that the city would let us shut down for a Saturday and a Sunday to shoot. And we were able to squeeze out a few hours a couple weeks before to do a dress rehearsal. That was our only chance to actually be on location and see how this really would work outside of, a dance studio or parking lots where we had rehearsed most of it before. The first dress rehearsal was kind of a...
fiasco?
Yeah, I think that's a kind way of putting it. The camera couldn't move fast enough. The winds up there were buffeting the crane. The dancing that looked really good when I would run around shooting stuff on my iPhone didn't look good in the sort of full engineered setup, and moves weren't being captured the right way, et cetera, et cetera. So we, you know, made adjustments. I'd say it was less kind of big overhaul adjustments and more just a lot of small tinkering, you know, adjustments. And then we went back when we actually had to shoot it with an idea of what was going to be troublesome, what was going to be easier to do, and we shot it. It's three shots sort of stitched together to look like one continuous shot.
So let's hear the song that's being sung in this opening dance number on the freeway. It's called Another Day of Sun. And you'll hear the concept of one person gets out of the car and starts singing, then another person, then a lot of people. You'll hear that build in this recording. So this is from the soundtrack of La La Land. That's Another Day of Sun from the soundtrack of the new film La La Land, and my guest Damien Chazelle wrote and directed this new musical. So I read that you almost took out this opening number, this like glorious opening scene that sets the tone for the whole movie, and that was this like huge triumph of filmmaking. Why were you considering taking it out?
Well, it wasn't the happiest few months of my life. We felt like we, you know, had gotten this scene the way we wanted it to, but we put the movie together and it just didn't, the entree into the world just wasn't working. And it wasn't because of the scene, as it turned out, it was because of everything that was around it. We used to have a big opening credits overture before the scene. We used to also see Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone's, you know, main characters before the number began, and then kind of refound them after. There was all this engineering around the number that seemed to make sense on the page, but didn't really make sense in the movie. So initially we tried lopping the number out. I mean, it's the only number in the movie that doesn't directly progress the story. So it's in some ways a number that you can cut out without too much collateral damage, except that obviously, yeah, I think we found pretty quickly that the movie needed it, and that led us to figure out solutions around the number and make the number itself. I think the way the number works now is as an overture, and that was the issue before, is that we kind of had three overtures before the story really started, and that was a problem.
So the Ryan Gosling character goes back to a gig that he really hated at a restaurant bar, playing not what he wants to, but playing mm-hmm. what he's supposed to. And it's the holiday season, so he has to be playing Christmas songs, which he really hates to do. And he's working on an original piece of his own. So I want to play a scene where he returns to this bar restaurant to take this gig, and J.K. Simmons plays the manager of the place. And so this is the strained interaction that they have.
Hey. Bill? Thanks for having me back.
You're welcome.
I want you to know you're looking at a new man.
Good.
Man that's happy to be here.
Excellent.
Very easy to work with, man.
Okay. And you're going to play the set list.
Happy to. Even though I don't think anyone cares what I play, but
yeah. Well, if by anyone you mean anyone other than me, that would be correct. I care, and I don't want to hear the free jazz.
Right. Okay. Although I thought in this town it worked on a sort of one for you, one for me type system. How about two for you, one for me? How about all for you and none for me?
That's perfect, yes.
Great.
Okay.
Okay, mutual decision then.
Right, made by me.
Right. and I sign off on it, so.
Whatever, tell yourself what you want to know.
Well, welcome back.
There's a nice way to say that, Karen.
And that's J.K. Simmons and Ryan Gosling in a scene from the new movie musical La La Land. My guest, Damien Chazelle, wrote and directed the film. So this is the second film that you made with J.K. Simmons, because he was the teacher in Whiplash. Did Whiplash help you make, like, could you have made La La Land without having made Whiplash first?
No, I tried to. I wrote La La Land maybe about 3 years or so before shooting Whiplash. I'd been developing it with these two young producers, Fred Berger and Jordan Horowitz, and with my composer, Justin Hurwitz, and none of us really had any traction in getting it off the ground. And Whiplash, finally, you know, once that got made and once that played at Sundance, where it premiered, then there was a moment where we had a little bit of mileage, and suddenly this project that no one in Hollywood had any interest in suddenly had a little bit of heat that we were able to kind of squeeze into.
So the film that you made before La La Land, Whiplash, was about, starred Miles Teller as a college music student, mm-hmm. who's a drummer and really wants to make it as a jazz drummer. His teacher, played by J.K. Simmons, is kind of like a drill sergeant teacher. I mean, he's kind of sadistic, really, mm-hmm. in how he insults the students and with the drummer just makes him go like faster and faster and mm-hmm. faster. Not that faster is necessarily good mm-hmm. in music. Watching that film, I think we all wondered, so were you ever really serious about playing music before you became a filmmaker? Was that your first dream?
It wasn't my first dream. Movies really did come first, and I can never remember a time where I didn't want to make movies. But music did become more than a hobby. There was a sort of, I guess, phase in my life. You know, it was mainly high school into college where music and specifically jazz drumming, as you see in Whiplash, was everything for me. And, it had a lot to do with a very intensive jazz program at my high school that I was a part of and a very demanding teacher. And certain emotions I felt as a young player where the kind of enjoyment and appreciation of the art of music was inextricably wrapped up in fear and dread and anxiety about, getting something wrong, anxiety about not living up to a certain impossible standard. And then the drive that came out of that fear, the drive to practice and to just make myself, turn myself into something that maybe I was never capable of becoming. Turn myself into a great musician just through work, and I think a lot of Whiplash in some ways was the most kind of autobiographical thing that I had written up to that point. At the point that I wrote Whiplash, I'd been paying the bills in LA mainly by writing genre pictures and sort of doing rewrites on horror movies and sequels and stuff that was very not personal to me, but I was just trying to make a living. And Whiplash was, I sort of thought, okay, well, maybe there actually is something and experiences that I had as a drummer that I never thought would be ripe for a film. Maybe I could kind of write those experiences as though it were a genre film, as though it were a thriller or a kind of war movie or a sports film, something where you expect to see a lot of physical violence and try to sublimate that violence into emotional violence, into the music and into the style.
When you were really into drumming and you were considering being a musician, even though filmmaking was your number one, were you afraid that you'd never be good enough at either? That you'd have these passions and really want to do something really badly and really work hard at it and still not be good enough, not at jazz drumming and not at filmmaking either?
Yeah, I think I probably still have that fear. The idea that just wanting something isn't enough or wasn't enough.
And neither is working hard.
And just working hard, exactly, wasn't enough. And that idea of where does talent come from? Where does that certain extra level of brilliance in whether it's the drummers or the filmmakers that I was idolizing, where does that little seed come from? And you don't know for sure whether you actually, you know, quote unquote, have what it takes. And also you don't know if that whole idea of having what it takes, is that actually its own kind of nonsense, you know? Is talent even really a thing? Is it actually just that the best musicians are the musicians who worked the hardest, or the musicians who listened the most, or the musicians who were lucky enough to be at a certain place at a certain time, and that what we think of as a meritocracy is actually not, is actually luck of, you know, sort of luck of the Irish. I think all those questions were swirling around my head and are still, I think, to a certain extent.
Have you had recurring nightmares about either music or movies?
I still, to this day, have nightmares of being a drummer in high school and being either at rehearsal or on stage and realizing I don't know the chart. I don't know the song we're going to play. Or I start playing and I'm just, it's like trying to drive a car in a dream. I have no control over my limbs and I'm just going in 8 different directions and it's terrible. And the conductor, my high school conductor, is looking at me and ready to tear my head off. I have that dream probably once a month.
Still?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's interesting that you'd still have it after having made a couple of successful films.
No, I have that dream more often than I have whatever equivalent for filmmaking would be. I don't often have the, you know, I don't know what the equivalent would be, sort of being on set and of a film and not knowing what I'm doing, or being at a screening that's of a film of mine that's going badly. I've had those occasionally, but I don't have those regularly. My regular anxiety dream that I can kind of count on coming every once in a while, like clockwork, is a drumming dream.
Damien Chazelle, thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you for making La La Land.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Damien Chazelle wrote and directed the new movie musical La La Land. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Mooj Zaidi. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive, offering policyholders the option to bundle home and auto insurance coverage. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from Inada, maker of the Dreamwave massage chair, Japanese crafted with shiatsu point detection and 16 pre-programmed massages. Learn more at inadausa.com. That's INADAUSA.com.